This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Nearly 25 million people from around the world came to the United States from the late 19th century through the first decades of the 20th century, and among these immigrants were children. On the program today, we're going to talk about the experiences of these young immigrants with historian Melissa Clapper, author of Small Strangers, The Experiences of Immigrant Children in America, 1880 to 1925. Clapper says these children came from around the world. In addition to the immigrants who came from Europe, there were also newcomers from Mexico, Canada, and Japan. And Clapper says these children played an important role in shaping the United States in the 20th century. Immigrant families, by necessity, relied on everyone in the family to help put food on the table. But immigrants, parents, and children were coming to an America where ideas about childhood were changing. They were no longer seen as small versions of adults. Children were to be protected. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Melissa Clapper teaches history at Rowan University in Glassboro, New Jersey. She's written a great deal about immigration and ethnicity in American life. She's the author of Jewish Girls Coming of Age in America. Her new book, Small Strangers, is published by Ivan R. D. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Melissa Clapper, welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
I mentioned that the way people viewed children was changing in the latter half of the 19th century. What led to that shift in attitude?
Well, one of the major changes was actually industrialization. On family farms, everybody pitched in from the earliest possible ages until they literally could not work anymore. But industrialization moved most people's workplaces out of the home, and since that was the case, children began to have some space for themselves where they were not just seen as small adults. There were also changes having to do with differences in religion. Earlier ideas about children had kind of focused on infant damnation, ideas that from youth children were born corrupted and that had to be gotten out of them by physical violence if necessary in the earlier colonial period. But by the 19th century, there was an idea that if families could keep their resources together enough, they would be able to protect their children in a variety of ways. And one of those ways was with education. And so as the public school system began to develop in the 1820s and 1830s in the early republic in the United States, there became widespread ideas about how to keep children separate for in education. This applied less to adolescents at that stage, but that was coming too towards the end of the 19th century.
This change in attitude, was it concurrent with the growth of the middle class?
Yes, it is. It's very class-related because, of course, the idea was to protect children and to give them some time and space to be children, not to be adults, not to work, to have the time and the luxury of education. But in practice, relatively few families could actually afford that. And so although it was a goal for many working families across racial and religious and ethnic backgrounds, in practice, it was mostly the middle class that could afford to do that.
Yeah. Working class families needed the efforts of everybody to survive. How were native-born working class adults and children affected by the shift in attitudes about childhood? Was their situation different from immigrant families?
Well, it might have been easier for native-born families to achieve this goal. There's the idea of what's called the living wage, which in theory was the idea that one person, typically the adult male head of the household, would be able to earn enough money on his own to support an entire family. This was the dream and remained the dream into well into the 20th century. And it was easier for native-born families to achieve that, although by no means was that very widespread. The middle class was relatively small. It did grow, however, as industrialization expanded the American economy and more management positions became available.
In the second chapter of Small Strangers, you introduce readers to a book, the title, How the Other Half Lives. And it was interesting to me to realize that so often we'll say, well, that's how the other half lives. Mm-hmm. And we don't mean Poor people, we mean the other half up above us.
That's right.
And here, it was the title of a book published in 1890, How the Other Half Lives. Who was its author?
The author was a man named Jacob Riis, who was himself a Danish immigrant. He came to the United States during the earlier part of what would become the progressive movement, and he was very interested, as were other progressive reformers, in making the world around him a better place. And he thought that one of the ways to do that would be to arouse the conscience of the wealthy people and upper middle class people who had the money and time and resources to help fix their world. And so he set off with a brand new technology, that of the traveling photographer. Of course, photography was not new in the 1890s, but now he was able to go with what he called a raiding party, as if they were going to hunt, and they went to hunt down photos of slum life in New York. And his whole perspective to do that was not was to expose how horrible life was in the slums of New York, particularly as immigration was picking up and the conditions were becoming more and more crowded. And he hoped that he would get people to realize that there was a whole other half the world out there. They lived horribly, and they should get up and do something about it. He was a very prominent social reformer of the day and one of the earlier ones to become nationally important.
Yeah, and now as we're seeing children at this stage as innocents, what better way to poke at the middle and upper classes than to photograph and tell the stories of children in dire situations.
Yes, and Jacob Riis understood. He was a very canny publicist. He actually, before he published the book, he actually had taken these photos, turned them into essentially a slideshow, what, you know, what he called a magic, what was then, given the technology at the time, a magic lantern show, and he took it on the road. And he actually, you know, went from place to place showing these photographs and trying to get people to feel sorry for the children. Because now that there was this idea that childhood was a time of innocence, the children themselves could not possibly be blamed for the horrible circumstances in which they lived. Some people were very willing to blame the adults. So he was really hoping that by focusing on children, he would be able to get people to say, to stand up and to say, we have to do something about this.
Hmm. To what extent did exposés like How the Other Half Lives affect the drive for reforms in housing and education and working conditions?
Those exposés were extremely important. The Progressive Era was a time when reform was becoming more and more a part of social commentary, of the way that society was conducted. There was a sense that it was time to fight back against ideas from earlier in the 19th century, an idea of kind of social Darwinism, which had said that people basically got what they deserved and that the fit would survive and that people who were having trouble in this world were having trouble because they were weak, either morally weak or physically weak or in some other way undeserving of the growing riches of the world. The progressives said, no, that's not the case. It's almost a nature versus nurture environment. They said, you know, people are not naturally weak. They're not naturally inferior. Their environment leads to major discrepancies. And as people became wealthier and wealthier at the turn of the century, these discrepancies grew so great that progressive reformers decided one of the best things to do was to study these problems and expose them. Not everyone was so happy about this. The reformers who wrote these exposés were also referred to as muckrakers, and that was not a compliment at first. Now we kind of laud investigative journalists, and we think that they can really draw attention to things that are wrong. But when this first started, it was a very questionable kind of practice. It did often lead to good results, though.
Hmm. It changed our ideas about the role of government, didn't it? How?
Yes. Government... Not in the way that we understand it today. I mean, what we need to remember about the late 1800s and early 1900s is that there was no government welfare social welfare net. There was no safety net provided by the government on any level. Everything was pretty much private. So that even Jacob Riis did not expect that the federal government was now going to step in and improve housing standards. Eventually, these things did happen. New York, for instance, passed in 1901 a set of standards for housing that would improve housing that would be built from then on, although it was not retroactive. But it was a much more localized kind of effort. First, you know, in this earlier period, the idea was to get private enterprise involved, to get wealthy people to devote some of their time and their charity to making things better for their own workers in some cases. Then maybe on the local or municipal level, they could get something going. Then on the state level, the federal level was not really involved until much later. You don't see major federal social welfare policy kind of across the board until FDR becomes president during the Depression, and then the New Deal programs do that. So there's a kind of, there are many different layers of reform, moving eventually along a spectrum from private to public.
Yeah. Did these efforts in the private sector and among charitable organizations, did they, though, put the country on track for the New Deal and then later the Great Society?
They did. I mean, you can draw a line. There are, you know, the United States, if you look at American history, and this is true in most Western countries as well, there are periods of reform followed by periods of a kind of retraction. And here we have, during the late 1800s, early 1900s, a major, major period of reform, which then was followed in the 1920s by a certain amount of retraction, then reform again in the 1930s. So you do see a cycle. And also what happens is that as more and more people become involved with these reform efforts, they decide, in the spirit of the, you know, modern age, that they should try to make it as scientific as possible. And so you go from kind of charitable initiatives to a more organized philanthropic set of initiatives to eventually social work, which was a much more kind of rationalized, professionalized thing. So then in 1890, some of the families that Jacob Riis was photographing might have had some contact with a charitable institution. They might have come in and probably tried to investigate them to see if they deserved the charity. Then shortly thereafter, you have middle-class young men and women moving into settlement houses in the neighborhoods, things like Hull House in Chicago, and beginning to take an interest in actually living in these communities and learning about them. And that's eventually moving towards the professionalized social work.
Yeah. It's interesting to think back at the charitable efforts and efforts within and among members of a community. In my hometown, there still exists something that's called the Singing in Six Society.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a recreational group. It was a way to hold together traditions and culture. And it was also a way to come together and help people out who were ill, who needed money to pay the doctor.
Yes, and actually the idea of private, you know, initiative is certainly not new to the end of the 1800s. I mean, immigrant groups had always had groups and things like Knights of the Columbus. These were always groups that, you know, worked within communities. Certainly immigrant groups coming over had their own fraternal organizations, and that was true, you know, across different kinds of ethnic groups, whether it's to gather money for death benefits or for burial plots if people get sick. That wasn't new. When it's from the outside, the earlier even some of the later manifestations of kind of charity and then social work were helpful, but they also had a certain amount of social control overtones. So, for instance, Protestant missionaries would run schools on the Lower East Side in New York, for instance, where they would, in fact, provide food and sometimes bathing facilities for children who didn't have access to that, but there was a payoff. Those children were also then subject to pretty extreme missionizing, which for Catholic and Jewish parents was very problematic.
Yeah. So we have an idea of saving children, literally.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that meant different things to different people.
Right, right.
And it was very rare to find a total altruist, actually.
Yeah. People like Riis, you note in the book Small Strangers, cared about the well-being of immigrant children, but they could run roughshod over parents. You want to give us an example or two of that?
Sure. Well, that was particularly true for immigrants because you have, starting from about 1880, you know, a huge wave of immigration. There had been immigration in the United States before, certainly, but it slowed down considerably during and after, right after the Civil War. But now you have immigrants coming over in very large numbers from places where fewer immigrants had come from before, places like Mexico, places like Eastern and Southern Europe. So there's very large numbers of Eastern European Jews, of Southern Italians, coming to the United States during this period. And the reformers really thought that it was useless for them to spend a lot of time trying to make the parents into something that they weren't going to be or wouldn't be able to become. Instead, they thought they should focus on the children, so that there were schools all in urban areas, in particular, all over the country that took these children in, were very happy to give them an education, but insisted, for instance, that they speak only English, and they washed out their mouths with soap if they spoke Polish or French or Japanese or whatever the language in question was. So on the other hand, these children would go home to parents who might not have had the time or the opportunity to learn English at all yet, and so the children were often caught between traditional values and what was being imposed on them at school. My favorite story about this is an incident in New York in the very early 1900s, I think it was 1906, when in one of the schools on the Lower East Side, there was a very well-known district superintendent, a woman who was insistent that all her charges learn English immediately and become American and conform to American health standards immediately, which was a problem for children in tenements who did not have access to running water for the most part. There was a tonsillitis, little mini epidemic in one of these schools, and the teacher and the superintendent decided that the way to treat this was to have all the children's tonsils taken out, a relatively new operation at the time. They sterilized the school, they brought doctors and nurses in, and they proceeded to go about these operations. But they neglected to tell the parents that this was going to happen. And so you have children running home to their parents and saying to their mothers, come, they're slitting our throats in the schools. And the mothers, got together, they were infuriated, they hadn't even been consulted, and they got all their pots and pans and rolling pins, and they basically broke down the doors of the school and took their children back.
Oh, wow.
And that's a rather extreme example of the unbelievable miscommunication, or just lack of communication, between parents and agents of Americanization who were eager to help, but only on their terms.
Yeah. Well, of course, we saw this happening with American Indian children as well.
Yes.
Yeah, same kind of thing. Were there public health campaigns?
There were public health campaigns, and they adapted to the new immigrant groups who were living in urban areas. So, for instance, there were major campaigns about clean milk. Many private and then state and more often municipal organizations provided clean milk, and they really tried to encourage mothers to get their milk only from these clean milk depots. That was one public health campaign. There were other public health campaigns that encouraged mothers to breastfeed their babies as the healthiest thing. That was the current scientific thinking at the time. So there were public health campaigns, and in fact, conditions did improve dramatically. Things were much better in 1925 than they had been in 1890. The infant mortality rate was shockingly high in the late 19th century. Something like 20% of children did not live to the age of five. That number, although still high by our standards, had dropped enormously by 1925. And that also has to do with the process of urbanization, municipal development, getting better sewer systems in place, for instance, purifying water. I mean, things that we just take for granted were not part of the urban landscape until relatively recently.
Yeah. And the issue of water was something that is very interesting. You tell a story in the book about Milwaukee and how the breweries in a sense lent a hand to improving the situation in terms of providing water for washing.
Yes, well, it turns out that at least whatever the beer, I don't know what the beer process is like today, but about 100 years ago, that it involved byproducts of a lot of clean water that had already been boiled. And so this beer company in Milwaukee decided to donate the water to public baths, basically, available to the entire community. Whether they would have done that if they had not been producing the water anyway is an open question.
Yeah, but one thinks it would be good for, labor relations as well, wouldn't it?
Yes, although it's not clear. In that case, I'm not sure that they only helped the people who were working for them.
Right. But nonetheless, I mean, one...
Yes, and you do see that there are big corporations, especially towards the end of the period that I'm writing about, into the 1920s, you see the development of something called welfare capitalism, where in order to stop unionization, which had been achieving some success after some very violent labor struggles immediately after World War I, big companies said, okay, we're going to give you X, Y, and Z, but we're not going to allow you to unionize. We'll give you some of the benefits that you are insisting on, and we'll give you some extras, but we are not going to let you unionize. And so some of the public health initiatives come out of this sense of welfare capitalism, which did improve people's daily lives in many cases, but sometimes at the cost of achieving other kinds of labor gains at a later date.
Mm. How many children were gainfully employed in this period?
It's very difficult to put an actual number on that. The rate of child labor was extremely high, and this was true for native-born populations as well. There was some variation. African-American children actually sometimes worked less, at least in the North, because in the North there was such prejudice against African-Americans that children even that had a very difficult time finding a job, and their mothers were very likely to work. Immigrant children were extremely likely to work at some point in their very young lives, sometimes full-time. Sometimes they worked on odd jobs after school. Very few of them were able to graduate from high school. There was very little interest in the child labor law. One was actually passed as part of a different kind of labor law in 1916, but the Supreme Court almost immediately declared it unconstitutional. So, in fact, children were an extremely important part of the economy. And although the Department of actually an immigration commission in 1911, and then the Department of Labor did keep some statistics. They never counted, and I may be mistaken about this. I think they still do not count agricultural labor of children. And so that means that whatever the numbers are, they were always too low, because there were, of course, many immigrants who were working on the farms, working in a rural economy, and those children certainly always worked. Mm. So the experience of the average immigrant child certainly included work at some point or another. Even if they were in school, they might work after, they might do that after work. In some cities, there were almost pitched battles between the newsboys who worked full-time as newsboys and the ones who worked after school to sell the evening papers.
So the ability to go to school was affected by whether or not you had to work and how long.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Were there gender differences? Did boys and girls do different kinds of jobs?
Yep. Just like the adult labor economy was segregated by gender, so was the child's labor economy. Children, for instance, girls would be working in textile factories where adult women were working, doing certain kinds of jobs that were just available to them. In coal mines, boys did all that work. Girls were very rarely found in coal mines. So you see a replication of what was happening in the adult labor market, and men and women had fairly segregated jobs during this period, so that it's not really surprising to find that boys and girls did too. When they worked at home, that might have been less the case. So, for instance, a poor immigrant family where the whole family works all day, every day, 12 to 14 hours a day, cracking nuts or making matchboxes or sewing silk flowers, in those cases, in a kind of family environment, young boys and young girls might have been doing the same work.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Melissa Clapper, the author most recently of Small Strangers, The Experiences of Immigrant Children in America, 1880 to 1925. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. During this period of history, was school attendance mandatory?
It depended where you lived. In urban areas, school was technically mandatory sometimes, but it was almost never enforced. It was to nobody's advantage to enforce it. Many families didn't want mandatory education because they needed their children to work. School officials did not know what to do with themselves. The schools were unbelievably overcrowded as a result of the immigration, and so they also actually did not push for mandatory education or for its enforcement because they physically could not cope. We talk now, I mean, nowadays in contemporary America about school overcrowding, and, you know, the red flag goes up if there's 30 kids in a classroom, but the typical urban classroom, say, in 1907 would have had 50 or 60 children, only one teacher, probably not enough desks, definitely not enough books.
Hmm. Given that problem, overcrowded schools, we've got public health issues, we have, booming urban populations. How are immigrants and their children seen by native-born Americans of the period?
Well, it depended who you were. If you were a factory owner, immigrants and their children were often seen as factory fodder. Somebody needed to work, and there were not enough native-born Americans. In fact, the birth rate of native-born Americans had been dropping steadily since the colonial period, and it was beginning to have an impact on an industrial system that just needed more and more and more workers. So there was welcome in that sense, but in the economic sense, sometimes, and for some workers, but only as long as they were necessary. So you see flare-ups of prejudice and discrimination that really march in tandem with the economic cycles. During, for instance, the Major Depression, what was called the Panic of 1893, that lasted for the next 3 years or so, there was quite a bit of anti-immigrant discrimination. As soon as that panic was over, it ended, in some places at least. So there are cycles. And it's also the case that it really depended where you were coming from. Scandinavian and German immigrants were almost always, if not welcomed with open arms, immediately, eventually welcomed, seen as productive members of society and generally integrated into the culture. People who were coming from so-called undesirable locations or who were seen as racially distinct, for instance, Mexicans or Asians, people who were seen as religiously suspect, Jews and Catholics, were treated with an enormous amount of prejudice and discrimination. I think we tend to forget that today, that it's not, there's nothing, you know, as they say, there's nothing new under the sun. The prejudice and discrimination that some immigrants feel today is not, unfortunately, new. And it wasn't new in the 1890s and in the 1910s either, when the Irish, for instance, came in huge numbers in the 1840s and 1850s. They were treated terribly in the United States. And, of course, unfortunately, it's been a pattern in U.S. history that the grandchildren of one set of discriminated against immigrants then become people who discriminate in their own turn three generations later.
Yeah. I guess it's unfortunate, but it's understandable.
Yes, it's about competition, really. Yeah. Competition for jobs, competition for housing. You had a series of race riots, for instance, following World War One. That was almost all, you know, ethnic groups fighting, eventually violently, African Americans who are, you know, looking for similar kinds of industrial jobs. They were seen as a threat because they might work for less money. So there's an enormous amount of competition over resources, and because there's no government control of any of these resources in many cases, that actually makes it worse, I think.
Yeah. There's a great story in the book about a place in the United States where, at least for one little boy, things weren't too terrible. Ernesto Galarza,
yes.
Lincoln School, Sacramento, California. What was his experience?
Well, Ernesto Galarza was a boy from Mexico who came with his mother from Mexico by stagecoach, which was a very different way to get to the United States than sailing into the harbor and seeing the Statue of Liberty, obviously. He was running away from he and his mother were trying to escape from the earlier parts of the Mexican Revolution, and he ended up in a city in Sacramento where there was an enormous immigrant population, and as a result, the public school that he went to had a very diverse population. And the teachers there had apparently decided that, although they certainly were going to insist on good English, and you know, they were not, and an Americanization in a cultural sense, they were not going to allow the children to discriminate against each other very much. So they didn't allow some of the expressions of prejudice that were certainly open in these children's home environments when they went home. And so Ernesto Galarza went to a school where where the principal and the teachers were very careful to try to integrate the children into the community. For instance, they would have the fire chief and the police chief come and speak to them. So he was able to build a kind of bridge from himself, which is the position that many immigrant children took. They were both part of the old world as the children of their parents, but also part of the new world. So that he was somebody who, for instance, was interested in joining the Boy Scouts, an integrated group that had children from many different backgrounds, but at the same time was also considered an altar boy candidate at the Catholic church that his family attended, in which you know, all the members were Spanish-speaking. And that was the experience of many immigrant children, that they themselves became bridges from one world to the next.
Yeah. You quote from his book, Barrio Boy, at the beginning of the chapter, At School, At Work, At Home, At Play. And he had a teacher by the name of Miss Hopley, who obviously he had a great deal of respect for. And he says, the school is not so much a melting pot as a griddle, where Miss Hopley and her helpers warmed knowledge into us and roasted racial hatreds out of us.
Yes, it's a nice turn of phrase, and it was, you know, probably true for him or the way he perceived it. I should note that, you know, an issue with many of these sources is that they were written many decades after the people who wrote them were actually in those schools. So that's not to, you know, cast any aspersion on his particular experience. But he certainly didn't have that turn of phrase, yeah. You know, when he was 11.
are there many accounts of immigrants writing about what their lives were like as children?
Yes, there are. I mean, of course, one always, as a historian, I always wish that there were more and more and more. But there are, actually. In the 1960s and 1970s, in early 1970s in particular, there was a kind of a resurgence in ethnic interest in the United States. Many different groups were kind of defining themselves. I mean, to put it painted in very broad strokes, this is the time when African Americans were making some headway in terms of civil rights and, you know, becoming interested in African American or in African culture. Many other ethnic groups also experienced an ethnic resurgence. And so what you see in the late 60s and early 70s is a kind of spate of publications of memoirs, similar to the memoir publication spate that we're experiencing now, actually, but in a very targeted sense, this is what my ethnic experience was like. So you have some memoirs that were written earlier. The 1930s was actually another time for that. Some of the programs of the New Deal encouraged people to really write about their childhood experiences. And you see it again in the 70s. There was also a real interest in oral histories in the 1960s and 70s, so that many, many communities had projects where they went out and tried to find out what life had been like in those communities several decades before. And so there's actually quite a bit of source material for what the life of immigrant children was actually like, how they felt about it and how they experienced it. It's just that as a historians, you have to be a little careful how you read things mm-hmm. because people do tend to remember a little bit through rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, yeah. Taken together, are there certain themes that emerge from these accounts about the immigrant experience through the eyes of children?
Yes, there are certainly some themes. One I do think is this theme of education. Education was extremely important for immigrants and for their families. For many immigrants, free education in America was a major motivating factor for coming to the United States to begin with. But related to that is another theme, and that is the theme of what we would now call the generation gap. The result of education, the more successful immigrant parents were in securing education for their children, the further away they often ended up from them. And that was something that everyone could see at the time, but there was not much they could really do about it. Mm. It was just, you know, one of the tragedies of immigration, and this is true not only in the United States, is often that the more successful children are, the less close they are able to remain to their parents. Social workers at the time commented on it. Parents often noted it, but it was almost an inevitable consequence. So that's another theme, and it's one that, you know, it leads to all kinds of family complications. And another thing that I found very interesting was to see that although I looked at a very large number of different ethnic and immigration groups, although there were obviously important and very striking differences among them, there were also some striking similarities. That structurally, a lot of immigrants dealt with this problem in the same way. They tried to publish lots of ethnic newspapers. They tried to run language schools so that their children, even if they were forced to speak English at school, at home or in a kind of private environment, would be able to continue speaking their heritage language. Almost every group in America did that. And almost all of them failed. So that, let's say, if you take a city like Chicago, you have 25 kids in a class, each one of them has a different ethnic background. They have the same experience during the school day. That's something that they're all sharing, and there's some similarities there. After school, they would almost all go off to Greek school and Hebrew school and Japanese school and Swedish school. And there they would sit. Often they were forced to sit, and they would, you know, try to learn these languages. They often did not. So even though they were having a culturally specific language experience, the structure was the same. They were all doing it at the same time in similar kinds of environments, in church basements and synagogue vestry rooms, this kind of thing. And then they would go back home and be back to, you know, acting as bridges again.
Yeah. An awful lot of navigation going on.
Yes, and it was very difficult. You do see in the memoirs that, you know, especially I think people who wrote memoirs a little bit later in life and had children and often grandchildren of their own, you know, it's something that they recognized, especially as they got older and became parents and grandparents, how difficult it is and how difficult it must have been for their parents to see them going, you know, moving further and further away. Some settlement houses and, so you know, really sensitive social workers, people like Jane Addams in Chicago, were very aware of this and tried to get children to appreciate their cultures and to appreciate their parents, but not at the cost of giving up American identity. So there was always this kind of push-pull going on.
Yeah. And children, back to the schoolhouse and the school grounds, was it common for them to attempt to find common ground or to get along, to strike up friendships across culture, across identities?
Well, yes and no. I think many of them did just because of the sheer fact of their proximity to each other, if they were all in school together. But there was still quite a bit of suspicion and distrust. Asian immigrants were often segregated. It's, you know, a kind of a sad, you know, a sad footnote to what's already a terrible racial history in the United States that the Supreme Court decisions that were used to continually segregate African American children in what were certainly, you know, inferior schools were also used to segregate Asian children. As late as 1927, there was a Supreme Court decision that said in Mississippi that a Chinese girl would have to go to the quote unquote colored school. So those children, you know, really experienced a tremendous amount of prejudice, and there was not a lot of open arms there. Other children might be able to overcome differences, if you know, especially if their families were succeeding in the economic sense. It really depended a little bit on where they were living. In urban areas, it was very rare for ethnic neighborhoods to be completely insular. In rural areas, it was more likely.
Hmm. There's an excerpt from a memoir that opens the chapter Adolescent Years by a woman by the name of Hildesat Polachuk. And here we have a mixture of things being expressed. She's an American, but yet she feels that pull back to her family and her mother, and she won't tell her mother certain things about her life so as to spare her.
Yes, and in that case, Hildesat Polachuk was a Jewish girl. And she went to a party she went to a Christmas party.
Yeah.
And she went with a neighbor, and a neighbor that she had met in her, who lived on her street, somebody, an Irish girl that she really got along with, and they were friends, and probably even their mothers were perfectly able to get along with each other. But Hilda knew that her own mother would not have been so thrilled about her going to a Christmas party. But she did it anyway. Never told her about it. So in that way, she was willing to kind of do something that would maybe be flouting her mother's authority. In other ways, she had no interest in moving too far away from her mother. So Hilda, like the vast, vast majority of Jewish children and adolescents, for instance, when Hilda became older, she never considered for a moment not marrying somebody Jewish. And that's something that you see in lots of different ethnic groups. For instance, Danish immigrants, and German immigrants, whether in rural or urban settings, in the first generations almost never married outside their own ethnic and language and heritage group. So they had some decisions to make about how they were going to do it, who they were going to tell, who would they be hurting.
Yeah. Well, in the 1960s, that was pretty much the message still in the family that I came from, is to stick with your own.
Mm-hmm. Some families, but of course, the larger... society gets, both in its thinking and its numbers and in its diversity, the harder that is to hold on to.
Yeah. It didn't take. It didn't take. This was interesting to realize, Melissa, that when people first arrived from a place, let's say, for example, the example that you give in the book is from Italy, they thought of themselves not as Italian necessarily, but as Romans or Sicilians or from Genoa. But in America, they became Italian.
That's right. That's part of what one scholar has called invented ethnicity, the idea that what we now think of as ethnic groups actually did not exist at all back in the old country, so to speak. And the Italian example is the clearest example of that. And what's ironic is that in cities, let's say, like San Francisco, where there was a Little Italy had streets that were definitely Sicilian and streets that were definitely Genoese. And those children probably were not so encouraged to play with each other either. Their parents did not see themselves as having come from the same place. On the other hand, because they all spoke Italian, from the outside they were always seen as having come from the same place. They got categorized that way. Any sociological studies that were done categorized them that way. And so within a generation or so, when you have families that were worried about losing heritage, it seemed like there might be strength in numbers for them to begin thinking about themselves like that as well. And so you see that the Italian example is the clearest of that, but you do see it in other ethnic groups as well.
Yeah. Would you talk with us about the contribution of immigrants in what you call the development of the public culture of commercial entertainment? This is also very interesting as well. This is another way that immigrants changed the shape of America.
Well, a good example of that is dating. For middle-class families that have nice private homes and have a parlor with a piano in it and curtains that can be drawn, courtship could still have a very private feel about it. A young man could come to call on a young woman. They could sit, privately in the parlor and only have to worry about a pesky little brother watching them. They could have this, within a family environment. If you're in a tenement family with five children and three boarders in two rooms with no running water, there's no privacy. And so the only way for two young people to spend time with each other is actually outside of the home. And because of this, in urban areas, all kinds of commercial leisure and commercial entertainment became increasingly popular. Everything from amusement parks like Coney Island to going to the movies. Going to the movies in the early years was something that a very well-bred young couple would probably not do. But it's something that still well-bred, no doubt, but working-class couples had no choice but to do if they wanted anything like privacy. And so there's this explosion of commercial leisure and commercial entertainment that actually originates in immigrant and working-class communities and cities. And I think now we're used to the idea that culture supposedly trickles down, but in fact, in this case, it trickled up.
Yeah, a lot of culture trickles up, doesn't
yeah.
it?
A lot of food, for instance, trickles up. I mean, it became all the rage in the 1920s, for instance, for the bohemian middle class set, people who were, you know, had left their families and wanted to live a more real life. They spent a lot of time in Italian neighborhoods in large cities eating pizza. Right? This was very adventurous. When, you know, with that kind of food experimentation seemed much more natural to immigrant and working class families that lived cheek by jowl with each other and just got used to each other's food.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the same thing is happening today. There's a new Ethiopian restaurant in town. Let's go and try it.
That's right.
Yeah. Is there also a link here to the rise of our consumer culture?
I think so. I mean, because, you know, that's related also, or maybe even more importantly, to industrialization and to the idea of mass production. To the idea that, you know, now that more and more labor is mechanized, the price of things goes down enormously. And a good example of that is clothing. Clothing was, you know, relatively expensive at the turn of the late 19th, early 20th century. But all the Italian and Jewish girls who were working in sweatshops and in textile factories knew what the latest patterns were going to be because they were making them. And so they found ways to copy them less expensively. And so they were able to look the same way, or at least they thought that they did. They were often criticized for being too overdressed for their station. But they were able to reproduce, you know, the newest hats or the newest clothes. Now, of course, the very wealthiest people were not buying factory-made clothes. But the middle class was. And so working-class girls were able to imitate the clothing patterns of middle-class and upper-middle-class women because they were producing them anyway.
Yeah.
So you see a kind of spread, you know, a kind of homogenization of culture there to some extent.
Yeah. Also, I would imagine in back to the schools, you have vocational training, home economics and shop classes and that kind of thing.
Yes, so, and all those things are controversial. On the one hand, you have people who are learning practical skills. How could that be bad? On the other hand, if you're learning practical skills because someone doesn't think that you're capable of learning the standard academic curriculum, that's not so good.
Yeah, you're being steered.
Right, and so there's a huge debate. This is where John Dewey and ideas about progressive education come in. There's a huge, huge debate that's not only about immigrants, but that mass immigration exacerbates, about what should be the content of education. What does it mean to be an educated person? Home ec is another good example of how cultural conflicts pop up in the oddest places. Because, for instance, in home economics, the thing that all girls learned how to do in home economics, and home economics during this period was only for girls, shop was only for boys, everybody in home economics learned how to make white sauce. You made white sauce, which was, you know, a combination of flour and milk, and you put it on everything. Well, if you're Jewish and you observe the Jewish dietary laws, you can't put milk on everything.
Right.
In fact, you cannot put it at all on meat. And so Jewish girls in home economics classes would come home in tears. They didn't know what to do. The prohibition is actually not only against eating it, but also against cooking it.
Yeah.
So they would come, and sometimes they just revolted and refused to do it. So there's another cultural conflict. On the other hand, they also brought home, you know, material and said to their mothers, maybe we should fry less and have more salad. And so eating patterns changed because of the material that schools brought to students who then brought it home to their parents. And that was a change for the better.
Yeah, very interesting. Anything you want to say here at the end to sum up, final thought?
Well, I just think that to me what was also interesting was to see, in terms of linking this to contemporary ideas about immigration, it was interesting to see what the definition of America was. The definition of American now is actually much more expansive because this is a country where there has been an entrance of so many different people from so many different places. But that was less the case 100 years ago. Then the ideas about what it meant to be an American were much more white, you know, kind of Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. It was actually a narrower definition that was more difficult to live up to in some ways. On the other hand, because there were so many immigrants coming at any one time, it was never possible to actually achieve that kind of homogenization despite all efforts to the contrary, to the point that actually the United States basically closed down immigration from 1924 until 1965. I think something we forget to think about when we discuss immigration policy today is that the United States has not always had an open door. It's a big myth to think that. It's a big myth to say that the United States was always a nation of immigrants. As early as Benjamin Franklin, Franklin complained about German immigrants to Pennsylvania. Starting in 1882, there was a series of acts passed that excluded certain groups, often Asian groups, from coming to the United States. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, and I'm certainly not suggesting that's necessarily a cause for limiting all immigration now. I certainly don't want to suggest that at all, but it's interesting to note that it's also not true that this country has always just had an open door.
There we'll leave it. Melissa Clapper, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
It's my pleasure, Celeste. Thank you.
Melissa Clapper is a historian. She teaches history at Rowan University in Glassboro, New Jersey. She's written a great deal about immigration and ethnicity in American life. She's the author of Jewish Girls Coming of Age in America. Her new book is Small Strangers, The Experiences of Immigrant Children in America, 1880 to 1925. The book is published by Ivan R.D.